Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence for SheerPost.com. And let me just say, today I'm going to be talking to Joel Whitney. And there's I'm first of all responding to a devastating article he wrote about the destruction of a writer in Indonesia, his imprisonment for over a decade, and so forth, at the hands of the U.S. government acting through the CIA, Indonesia, a country where we caused the death of a very large number of over a million people, disrupted the politics and so forth. And his article is very moving about the consequence of these interventions. You know, it's not a game, it's real, and it messes up, not only kills a lot of people, but really destroys the ability of other peoples in the world to make their own history, to find their own realities, deal with their own problems. So it's an anti-human, anti-freedom kind of empire of the world intervention. And my guest, Joel Whitney, has written two very important books. I've done previous podcasts on them. One is Finks, which is about how the CIA destroyed American intellectuals and co-opted them and recruited them and attacked them and so forth during the Cold War. And the other is Flights, about people having to leave this country to find some measure of freedom. What I want to talk about now, we're at a moment where Donald Trump, who experienced the wrath of the deep state, I mean, after all, the FBI invaded his house, the CIA and the people in the Defense Department all contributed to an effort to destroy this ex-president of the United States. And unfortunately, having been a victim of this deep state tyranny, instead of saying, we're not going to do that to anybody, he now seems to be maybe embracing it. I say maybe because it was early in his administration to turn it against. You know, he has no compunction at all about having the FBI arrest a Tufts Fulbright scholar or arrest a Columbia student who dared to speak out against American foreign policy. So what we know of people who have experienced the oppressive hand of the state, and I'll give Trump that, he certainly has experienced it, can go one of two ways, including, say, for instance, the experience with German fascism. Most Jewish people, for example, and most of the other victims, or families and members of other victims, say never again, it shouldn't happen to anyone. And then we've seen, as in the case of Israel and Gaza, some people say, oh, now we're going to be like them, so it won't happen to us again. Those are two very different, fundamentally different positions. So I want you to begin to introduce us. First of all, tell us what this article in Believer magazine that so impressed me was really all about, but really more important, why it's indicative of really the horrors. And that was done under a Democratic administration, LBJ. And the horrors that we visit upon the world, we're not the only ones, but we're the most powerful nation that has ever existed. So our ability to do the devil's work, and terrible, I would use the word mischief, but mischief hardly describes this kind of destruction of people. So take it from there.
Yeah, happy to, and happy to be back on the show. Thank you for having me. Yeah, what you're talking about is a figure that is super well known, I think, in Indonesia and outside of that, starts to become less well known. His name is Pramodya Ananta Tour. And in the mid 60s, while Sukarno was securely in power in Indonesia, there was allegations of a coup. Some of those who were supportive of Sukarno, who was a socialist in the style of Bernie plus a little something more, like Bernie actually going through a revolution. And he had done something post-independence that was super important, nation building. He had to build up a nation that had been under colonial rule for 400 years under the Dutch. And reliably, the United States didn't wait too long to start trying to meddle and even overthrow him. By the mid-50s, there were several attempts to overthrow him. By the late 50s, there was a coup that the U.S. supported, mostly through bombings. We lied about it, and our pilot was captured, and he was paraded in the media to show that the United States lies. Well, flash forward to 1965, a program of nation building is partnered with sort of cultural battles. The centrists, who are often aligned with the CIA through the Congress for Cultural Freedom and other groups, were battling with some progressives associated with an organization called LECRA. The chief of those, the sort of the most famous writer, award-winning novelist, was Primodia, who I mentioned earlier, Primodia Nantatour. And this attempt to stop a coup in 1965, after several other Western-backed coups had gone underway and failed, seems to have triggered some colonels loyal to Sukarno, the socialist, to kidnap a few generals who were reliably Western-tilting. Some of those generals were killed, and the next thing you know, the counter-coup was underway. Now, it's very murky what happened precisely and who ordered what, but Suharto came to power as a result of this, a general and a military dictator leaning fascist, and they started immediately to arrest all of those cultural figures tilting to the left and who were loyal to Sukarno. As you said, and as you know, hundreds of thousands, probably more than a million, Primodi himself thought it was between 2 and 3 million people were killed for being students on the left, for being socialists, for being Sukarno supporters, for being outspoken, for being Chinese Indonesians, because the Chinese Indonesians, much like the Japanese Americans here during World War II, were suspected of disloyalty and loyalty to China and therefore communism. So along with those deaths, many were rounded up, hundreds of thousands probably. You know, trials would have been mooted because so many people were being arrested. And the most famous internationally was Primodi Anantatur. His saga sort of starts there. It doesn't end until 14 years later. He was in a Far Eastern tropical gulag, 2,000 or so miles, 1,800 miles from Java. And he was not allowed to write. And in the late 60s, early 70s, he became kind of a cause for organizations like Amnesty. And as you said, this all started under Johnson, under the rubric of anti-communism. And in The Believer, which is an amazing magazine, sort of literary quarterly with a lot of reportage, I tell his story for Americans because Americans were so, you know, intimately involved with his repression. And he knew that. And he talks about that throughout his life. So that's where the article sort of jumps off from. And it's worth, I think it's worth reading. It's worth, you can, I think, if you want to subscribe digitally or in store, sort of physically rather, thebeliever.net/subscribe. You can read the article on the website as well, The Making of the Buru Quartet.
Now tell us about this quartet, because it's also, it's a major piece of work, a major work of art. And it actually tells a story that begins exists before his in confinement. It's been made into a movie. So talk a little bit about that. But I want to remind people where you know, they have a tendency, well, that's their fault and their business. It wasn't. It was U.S. intervention. I actually witnessed Sukarno in Cambodia when I was covering the Vietnam War in Cambodia and the spillover into Cambodia. And Sukarno dared to criticize U.S. policy in Vietnam at something called the Indo-Chinese People's Conference. And it wasn't long after that the U.S. moved to eliminate him. And he was, you know, by no means a communist or anything. He was an independent nationalist and I guess a social democrat. Yet the fact that he dared challenge American foreign policy, they destroyed him. So, you know, that's really what's behind all this. And so we are responsible, you know. And so when Trump says he's going to make America great again, he means what? Go back to creating gulags for other people. And when Hillary Clinton says no, he's wrong. America's always been great, as she did in her campaign against him. So we were great when we killed millions of people. And, you know, this is Holocaust level by any definition in their own country.
Yeah. Yeah, the Buru Quartet, part of the early part of your question, is just a masterful series of four novels. And the tropical island gulag where they sent him was called Buru. Sometimes Primodia called this labor camp. He sometimes referred to it as a concentration camp, and he certainly frequently referred to Suharto, the dictatorship that we supported, funded, and installed, helped install, a fascist one. And so to tell the story of the quartet, you can't leave off the labor camp that he was damned to by United States-backed anti-communism. And by the time you sort of hear the full story, you'll think of a certain aphorism that is inarguable. Not all anti-communists are fascists, but all fascists are anti-communists. And that's why over sort of the quote-unquote American century, so many people like Suharto were installed. But Primodia was at work on a collection of short stories when he was arrested on October 13th, 1965. He was sent to some prisons on Java, but
he was already a very famous writer.
He'd won some awards. He'd run and edited and written for a weekly column where he was making the case for Sukarnoism as he could feel the repression from the American-backed right hitting Sukarno. So he had a reputation for being a bit of a firebrand. He was associated with a cultural group that was sometimes seen as an adjunct to the Communist Party. And he's arrested as one of, if not the most famous literary writer in Indonesia. And as he's being arrested, Bob, he's got this dream that if he can put the history of Indonesia's independence movement from the time 100 or so years before he was, or maybe 50 years before he was born, up until the decade of his birth, if he could tell that story through a journalist named Tirto, then he would have done something magisterial in literature. And as he's being arrested, he's got the actual historical Tirto's diary in his possession, and along with all of his other research and accumulated works, they burn it in his yard as they're arresting him. And so after they realize their thrift is causing them not to feed him on Java, and that means that people can visit, families are encouraged to visit to bring food to the prisoners, but that also means where the media and the most of the population is based, again, Jakarta, Java, there could be journalists who will see the torture that is ongoing there. So someone thinks of this body of Eastern Islands called the Moluccas, where the Dutch used to send their exiles. And Primodia is one of between 12 and 14,000 of these super important exiles who get sent to Buru. He's remembering this figure that he wants to write about as soon as he gets there. He's met with, you know, a wild swing in temperatures, really hot during the day, cooling down by 30 degrees or so at night. It's not farmable conditions, but there's no other provision for their food but that they farm their own. So he's immediately damned to a regime of forced labor throughout those first couple of years, which are, you know, reliably described as the starving years. They're trying to figure out how to have side projects where they're farming fish like tilapia and maybe eels. They're growing food separate from the official barracks-based, rice fields. And he goes from daydreaming about his novel to realizing that if he's not allowed to have pen or paper there, that he has to start composing it somehow. So he comes up with something that in all of literary history, I can't think of another example quite like this. He starts to tell the stories during work breaks to his comrades. And by the way, his comrades are no schlubs. These are the intellectuals. So there's a lawyer there who knows colonial law historically. There's a school teacher named Tomiso who becomes a farmer back in his life before arrest. I'm getting a little New York construction sound. So all of these experts who are surrounding him are also kind of fact-checking his story as he creates it. He's trying to recover a memory of Tirto's life from the diary that was burned at his house when he was arrested. And at first, that's all he can do is to reconstruct the stories from memory orally. Eventually, his saga continues, and he witnesses death by suicide. He witnesses death by torture. He witnesses death for for other prisoners having written materials. You were only allowed to have a Quran or a Bible, I think, at that point in the late 60s and early 70s. And so eventually Amnesty gets involved. They make him sort of a cause internationally. And the regime, the Suharto regime, starts dealing with the Amnesty queries by bringing in these at first loosely curated, later deeply vetted junkets of journalists. And those journalists are given a kind of script where they say, well, you're only here because you're a communist, so why are you complaining? And he consistently pushes back with quotable responses that groups like Amnesty and Penn begin quoting, at deepening his international reputation as kind of a stubborn martyr for freedom of expression. Little by little, he just continues to play chess with the regime. And eventually, they decide that it's not worth the publicity hassle. They decide that they're going to give him and all the prisoners the rights that they lost when they were sent there. But if he's a writer, or if others of them are lawyers or farmers or whatever they are, they're also going to be given tasks for the regime. They're going to be, there's sort of a blending of the forced labor that they're doing with propaganda work for the regime. So finally, 8 years after his initial arrest, Promodia is given an attic above one of the administration buildings on this island, Buru, and he is finally allowed to write. He doesn't have any materials. A rumor has it that Jean-Paul Sartre sent him a typewriter. The goon squad, as it were, destroys the typewriter because I don't quite know why. His comrades get him another one, but they're very low on ink. So he writes out the first two of the four novels by hand after having told the stories for several years. It goes forward from there. He releases the first one in 81. He's finally released in 1979. Incidentally, the same year that Solzhenitsyn wins the Nobel Prize for Literature, Promodia is finally leaving his own gulag. And it becomes, the first novel is called This Earth of Mankind.
This is after he is released?
He's released in 79, and in 81, I think he releases This Earth of Mankind. This is a recent edition. And it shatters national sales records, but it's banned instantly by Suharto and the dictatorship. His publishing cooperative ignores the ban, and they publish the second one not long after. And people start to buy these books as photocopied samizdat. And he starts to win awards, and the story goes on from there. But it's kind of an astounding story of survival. He's not free when he's released. He's under house arrest effectively. He finishes the last two. It becomes the famous quartet. It's getting whispered about internationally, but it's also winning Penn Freedom to Write awards. It's winning Asian prizes like the Fukuoka and the Magsaysay from Philippines. So his reputation is starting to grow, but the key thing that one of his main translators, Max Lane, tracks, Bob, that I think is of interest to us, is the novels actually play a role. And if you're very skeptical, maybe, you'll take this with a grain of salt, but it seems to be well established by Lane and others that the protest movements from the 70s, after this group of intellectuals is arrested, every decade or so, there's a new protest by students. And they keep failing, but when and their only intellectual kind of mentors happen to be these CIA aligned guys who are starting to turn against Suharto, but who were collaborating with him when he came into power, people like Mokhtar Lubis, and Mokhtar in particular I single out because he was a member of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, linking this story back to my obsession in Finks, which is Congress for Cultural Freedom is a CIA backed cultural front. So Mokhtar and people like that, Mokhtar even visited him in the gulag and promised to help him get a hearing aid because he lost his hearing, promised to send him books for his research, never did. but was one of those guys who was vetted to grill him and to tell him, well, you're here because you're a communist. Have you discovered God? Because they were forced to register as Muslims in the Gulag. They were forced to register. They had like four official religions that they could choose from. So when he gets out, he sees that there have been these failed protest movements where the students have no actual progressive mentors to look up to. They have a lot of former centrists and anti-communists who now are effectively useless against a right-wing dictatorship that they helped install. But the protest movements keep failing because the students have no sense of what the left intelligentsia, who actually helped stop Dutch colonialism in the islands, in the Indies. But once they're freed, this sort of whole intellectual cohort returns, as Max puts it, Indonesia returns from exile. He talks about Indonesia as having exiled itself with the arrest and death of this many people. Now, you've had Vincent Bevins on the show before, Bob, and he talks about the killings as a method, the Jakarta method, which was then exported to Brazil and other places. But it is this kind of right-wing need to purge the left that is certainly au courant right now, and I know we're going to turn to that in a minute. But what's interesting in Max Lane's thesis, and I tell an abbreviated version at the end of this article in The Believer, is that what Promodia's books teach them about the independence movement, and by his very presence, having returned from exile, is that no student protest movement without labor, the feminists, the farmers, other left-wing groups, none of those can actually bring down a regime without this, and we call it intersectionality. And so finally, the protest movement that comes up in the 90s in the wake of the novels, in the wake of Promodia's return, actually succeed in bringing down Suharto in 1998. So it's instructive, and you know, it may be historically unique, but it does seem to me, if you look at Colombia and other student movements, that without solidarity, and certainly without the will to resist, you know, threats and other kinds of bullying, these movements can't achieve their ultimate goals. They can do a lot of good in the meantime. They can instill courage in us. They can push back against lies in the media about who they are and what they're doing. But Promodia is, you know, I pitched this long before Trump was elected to The Believer, and it did have a long time incubating. But as it was being finished and finalized and fact-checked, it was just interesting to me how relevant Promodia's life is to our moment.
We know there's a deep state. And we know it does all the terrible things that they keep it deep and they keep it secret, not because it's, you know, protecting the lives of heroic agents out there, but that it's concealing stuff that would be repulsive to most people in the world, including torture, of course, and certainly imprisoning Indonesia's, as it turns out, to be one of his most important writers, finally acknowledged after his death. But I want to address that question because, again, there are a lot of so-called liberal people who moderate Republicans or that as they used to be, and liberal Democrats or neoliberal Democrats who actually celebrate the deep state. And now they don't trust Tulsi Gabbard, who I don't know where she's swinging, but she's actually in a powerful position. But before her appointment by Trump, she was a critic of the deep state. She was somebody who served in the U.S. military, saw where lying gets you, where deceit, the role of deceit, and was objected to it. Whether she'll continue to read, this is an open question. We don't know. But, you know, power corrupts and people get in those positions. They suddenly find they can endorse things that they otherwise thought were horrible. And that certainly was the experience in Nazi Germany, where most of the well-educated people went along with justifying that system. So, you know, you've written about this your whole life. We now have Quiet here on the set. You know, really give us the broader picture, why you've devoted so much of your work, your brilliant writing, because I think this piece you wrote for The Believer is just incredible. I try to get permission to post it on our site. I'll try to send people to go check it out. But just as a work of art, as a piece of writing, it's really, that's why I called you to do this podcast. It's just terrific. And what makes it terrific is that you really put us there in the body and mind of a person, you know, as in the Julian Assange case, which most liberals forgot about and ignored. What does it mean to be confined for a decade? What does it mean to have your writing utensils taken from you and so forth? So take us there. You've written about this as persuasively as anyone.
Well, you're right on the money in terms of the confusion that we're under, that we're operating under in this moment of Trumpism. And there was a high watermark for me when I was trying to push back against some of the early Doge disasters on, you know, between protests, I have to do some of this work, forgive me, on social media. And one of my sort of old cafe buddies, who's a friend on, I think, Facebook, a former actor and maybe magazine editor, he came at me and he said, "You literally wrote the book, Finks, tells the story of how," I think he conflated the left somehow. He said the liberal left penetrated all of these groups and movements and the media and whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. He basically was lumping together the progressive left, let's say the Bernie left, and the Hillary Clinton, Biden center left, the pro-interventionist kind of center. And he therefore sort of destroyed the argument of Finks on his way to defending Trumpism. And I had actually seen that building online. There was this phrase that I kept seeing on Twitter, sometimes associated with Finks and sometimes just associated with the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And the phrase was the synthetic left. And instead of understanding the basic argument of Finks, which is that the new left, the true left, the Black Panthers actually creating healthcare in their Oakland and other neighborhoods for the community, and only taking up weapons in a militant posture to make sure they weren't killed by police, which many of them were anyway, rather than sort of putting that whole idea together as an effective left, same with the American Indian movement, which I read about in Flights, instead, the CIA penetrated that left with a fake left. That's the synthetic left. But the way people have been telling it online, and I think this tells us something about Trumpism, is that they assume that the left itself is this creation of somebody like George Soros. It's a complete misreading of the history. It's probably a deliberate misreading in some cases, but it's still powering Trumpism. It's still this idea that Trump is an effective and honest and earnest and sincere fighter against the deep state. And he burnished that reputation a little bit in his first term. But then if you look at actually who he could bring in, he didn't have any actual Trumpist people. He came out of the Tea Party, right? His whole career is launched as a politician by pretending Obama wasn't born here. Talk about nativism. But in the first term, he's surrounded by the neocons that are, I think, correctly sometimes lumped together with the so-called deep state. They're the interventionists. A lot of first-generation neocons like William Kristol came out of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the New York intellectuals. Some of them were frustrated Trotskyites who had been leftists once before. The Trotskyites always believed that art and culture could be a weapon in the Cold War. So they have this evolution. They started out on the left, but by the time neoconservatism is born around 1965, let's say, with the Public Interest Magazine, CIA funded, it's absolutely got next to nothing to do with the left, except that they have this wise idea of sort of banding together with the liberal centrist anti-communists. And so what they propped up was not leftism per se. It was a kind of ad hoc coalition, sometimes called the Washington Consensus, that would bring together anti-communist liberals with, you know, centrist sounding conservatives who became neocons to push this idea that the United States, A, had culture, B, was a freedom-based alternative to communism. C, could do anything that communism could do better. And, you know, a big part of that was through the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which created these magazines. When this was exposed in 67 and for many years thereafter, instead of really having a debate about what the Congress for Cultural Freedom was, the intellectuals are on the scene actually instead debating the Vietnam War. And if the Congress for Cultural Freedom had never existed, I think the intellectuals, Bob, would have behaved better in the lead up to the Vietnam War. I think a lot of them were co-opted by the time the Vietnam War arguments, and by the way, the Indonesian coup happened. So that's kind of the backstory. And what you're seeing, and Ken Roth has reminded us that Trump really wants a peace prize. So what I think the right under Trump is doing better than anyone could have imagined is on some level, even though they're half-assing it and they're all over the place on this, they're co-opting the anti-war impetus of the left. You know, term one, Trump tried to make peace between the Koreas. His heart on some level may have been in the right place, even as he was saying stupid things like Rocket Man. He seemed to be on both sides of it, depending on whatever caffeine or drugs he was on. So he's got this impulse that Ken Roth and others believe we should try to work with psychologically. Like, if he wants a peace prize, let him make peace where it's appropriate. And I think, by the way, it's always appropriate. On the other hand, he's even more vicious on Gaza and in Palestine and Israel than Biden was, if it's able to even be the case, if that's even possible. So what he's doing, he's signaling to his base that he's destroying parts of the government that he calls, giving him cover to destroy parts that he calls the deep state. And right there with that one move alone, he shows that he's already giving, I think, a more effective read on the population and the independent mindset and maybe even the Democratic Party's mindset. He's stealing voters for himself. I mean, his total vote count didn't go up in 2024. We know that. Kamala's went down, but part of why it went down is she's lost the anti-war consensus, which is a big part of the independent voter movement. And so it's very effective, even if parts of the government that he's destroying have nothing. Social Security has nothing to do with the deep state, but they're making it now. They're sort of linking the deep state, which is a corruption state, by the way. All of the work that the Congress for Cultural Freedom and other CIA agents or sub-agencies do, movements do, committees do, is they basically do government by bribery. That's what the whole Iraq and Afghanistan war, they were all fought by buying off stakeholders, basically, and using CIA agents and things like that. So there's definitely corruption in the apparatus around intelligence in the CIA. And it got worse after the war on terror because there used to be a whole side of the CIA that gathered information, reliable information. Some of that got subsumed by covert ops after the war on terror started. But the Department of Education is absolutely necessary to a democracy and good schooling and good universities and universities that have the right to protest. So a lot of what Trump's doing also, in addition to this idea of pushing back against the deep state, is he's pushing back against so-called anti-Semitism. So it's an amazing array of chess moves that, you know, there's another framework for all this that I think is interesting. Michael Parenti's book, Black Shirts and Reds, and other thinkers, I owe some of this sort of concept to the scholar Gabriel Roy Rockhill in Philadelphia. And it's this idea that when the liberal face, the sort of the moderate liberal face of capitalism is being challenged from the left, we saw this in the 30s, right? The United Front movement against evictions, you know, joining with the Communist Party and other left-wing groups to stop evictions. When that kind of left is on the ascendancy, like Bernie 2016 and Bernie 2020, then the good cop of liberalism has to cede ground to the bad cop of thuggish fascism. And that seems to me like the read that we're on. It doesn't mean that liberals agree or are, you know, behind the scenes working with the fascists. It doesn't mean that. It just means that there's a kind of process arrangement that has them working in tandem together, whether the liberals know it or not. And so the fascists sort of rally and know to step in when the liberal arguments for capitalism are not working, good cop and bad cop. And you know, another way to think of it is blowback, because Trump 1 was certainly less toxic than Trump 2 has been so far. He doesn't need to get reelected. That's a big part of it. But as you state, you know, the resistance against Trump, the lawfare, all of those things, again, he lumps them together as deep state. He doesn't encourage his voters to actually differentiate between a check and a balance and a deep state. Right now we're seeing that with arguments about whether judges should be impeached or not. And so I think everything you're saying makes sense. This blowback is very sloppy. It's very deliberate. You know, another thing that we see under far-right regimes, even under any Republican regime, is they're not the job creators that Democrats are. And when there's high unemployment, they get to make the argument for lower wages. It's just a win-win for them. So if a lot of people are out of work, then they'll take anything. They'll take it for lower wages. And so they can keep prices of labor down while people are being fired. So they make these things into a win-win, masterful.
Yeah. Well, let me just, I mean, we're going to run out of time, and I'm glad we're not being interrupted by construction noise. But, you know, capitalism is always going to be rapacious. It's always going to be expansionist. It's always going to be want to get new territory. So, you know, getting Greenland or undermining China and so forth, that is normal to capitalism. That's not Adam Smith's capitalism of an invisible hand where free entrepreneurs compete, but monopoly capitalism, which Adam Smith was against and that certainly existed before and after his time, you know, you basically are working with people and on Trump's side who are just being outrageously hypocritical in their use of words like communism and left. I mean, Trump has no trouble at all and will have no trouble at all making a deal with China, Red China. And even the Democrats, when they didn't want to make a deal with Red China, said, oh, Apple should move its operation to communist Vietnam. So the word communism has absolutely no meaning anymore when it's associated with powerful economies that can actually produce things and so forth. It's just a joke. And in fact, Trump knows this because he was the victim of this whole Russiagate garbage, which never made any sense because, after all, Putin is the guy who defeated the communists in Russia. Yes, he started out in their secret state bureaucracy and so forth. But so did Yeltsin, who we backed. He was a member of the Politburo, a leading member. And Yeltsin was encouraged to make way for Putin by our own government because Putin was sober and would advance cartel capitalism and open shop for everybody. So and it has nothing to do with communism. He's the anti-communist. So it's all nonsensical. And here even Trump, who was the victim of red baiting, they had stories, he's in bed with the Russians, literally, with the Asians. You know, they red-baited Trump, right? He's a Putin stool, even though Putin's not a red. On the other hand, Trump turns around and blames the protesters of Colombia for being communist or this dangerous left that's here. So anti-communism is like, as Orwell, who is certainly a very strong critic of the Bolsheviks, and, you know, nonetheless, it's the invention of an enemy, and you can call it anything you want. The distinction, I think you've raised an interesting, I don't mind going a little longer as long as we don't have construction noise. Bringing in Gaza is very, very important because what really Trump is all about is dealing with power in a way that will benefit the ruling group in America and maybe incidentally people who vote. You know, maybe tariffs might bring back better jobs and so forth. But he has to be very mindful of what, you know, Russia still has half of the nuclear weapons, you know, and so you have to care about them. And it was very interesting in the dressing down of Zelensky, where both Vance and Trump said, what do you mean, you want to bring on World War III? Yes, you push Russia too far, you can't get World War III. They have the wherewithal to do it. The Palestinians don't have anything. They never had an army. They were not responsible for whatever happened in the Six-Day War. That was with Egypt and Jordan that Israel made peace with. And so since you brought it up, what's happening with the Palestinians is you can oppress people who don't have power. and don't have a state even. They certainly don't have an army and what have you. And so Trump knows that. He can be the bully boy with the Palestinians. Now, he has a limit there. He can't go so far that Saudi Arabia, which already did not cooperate with Biden on cutting off, undermining Russian oil prices, you know, he has to be sensitive. There is, after all, a large part of the world that is sympathetic to Palestinians, maybe most of the world, and their right to have a state and so forth. So we don't know. At first, he forced a ceasefire. Now he's all for continuing the genocide there. You're absolutely right in bringing it out. But I think the interesting point about the deep state, and maybe we can wrap this up at least in the next few minutes, but you've written so much about it. The significance of the deep state, the reason anti-communism was useful, was not because some ex-Trotskyist intellectuals in New York wanted to do it. It's because American power came out of the World War II with the only major surviving economy in the world and now had to justify creating an empire, in effect. And the glue that held it together was anti-communism. We are the free world. We will save Europe from the communists. So forget about fascism. Forget about these agreements we had that Germany will be divided, never million. No, we were critical of Germany, only that it didn't bring up a military. And we used German scientists to help us develop better rockets and bombs and so forth. So I think the value of your research, and I want to recommend, I want to close this by recommending your book, Finks and Flights, your other work, as well as this article that I found so impressive, is that whether it's right-wing demagogues or neoliberal demagogues or what have you, they're going to do what Orwell predicted. They're going to find the enemy and get everybody to focus on the defined enemy instead of the enemy at home, the super wealthy, the exploitive, the cynical, you know, and the American torturers. The torture can be by just denying people decent housing, even though you're the richest country in the world and so forth. I think that's the big idea here. And the example, again, Brett's bring it back to the quartet. People can watch it, right, on the movie.
Yeah, the first of the This Earth of Mankind is on Netflix.
Yeah, and get into this issue, because what happened in Indonesia, which, by the way, is the biggest Muslim country, and we didn't care at all about religious freedom and Muslim fanaticism and Muslim terrorism. No, we just wanted to keep them, what the Dutch did for, as you say, 400 years, acquiescent to our exploitation of their resources and their life. And we did it so-called in the name of freedom. And it's just been garbage in, garbage out, you know. So maybe we could, I'll give you the last word and we could wrap this up. But it seems to me that's the value. We had no hesitation, just as we didn't have any hesitation keeping Julian Assange in prison, a high security prison under the most barbaric circumstance, and yet we claim we're for freedom all over the world. It's garbage. We were quite happy, when African people leading the fight for freedom in South Africa, Nelson Mandela and others, we called him a communist. He was kept in jail with our approval. We approved the segregationist government. I mean, you go right down. We killed Lumumba. I mean, the whole history is so sordid. And it's really sort of the main denial of the claim that we are the society of the free, that the vast, vast majority of Americans have no idea who killed Lumumba or who Lumumba was or where the former South Belgian Congo was or any of it. And the value of your research, I want to recommend people to check out your work, is you felt an obligation to keep digging into this sordid history and expose it. So my hat's off to you. You have a last word before we wrap it up? At least let's keep it to within 50 minutes.
Yeah, I'll keep it pretty quick. I just want to touch on a couple key points. Yeah, the Buru Quartet is made up of four books, and as a recommendation to your readers, the first three are like Dickens novels. And what's really interesting is the fourth one turns to his Fink, his collaborator, the secret police agent that arrests him tells the fourth, because he's exiled, just like Primodia was. And Primodia, again, is this novelist who becomes a blueprint for his country out of something like what Trumpism could become if he keeps his word when he says he's going to run for a third term and remove bans on a third term. But in addition to that, as we do think about Trumpism, and as I've looked at this series of books, is one answer to how protest movements need to band together in solidarity with intergroup collaboration and lots of mass protests moving towards a general strike. Even while I say that, thinking about your other points, Bob, you know, democratic socialism, I think Bernie and AOC have done a lot to reclaim that word. So what I'm seeing Trump use to try to do this anti-communist work of creating an enemy out of the left, he's saying the radical left, the radical left. And AOC is out there stumping with Bernie to say, you know what, you've been hoodwinked. I'm not going to blame you. This guy's a liar. He's got lots of propaganda at his disposal. The right is ascendant right now in propaganda, memes, video games, and everything in between. But what she's saying is what you call on the right radical leftism, I call common sense. And she's talking about the healthcare that is the norm across Europe. So we really have to get our heads on straight and understand that even if Trump says he's against the deep state, effectively what he's doing is so far an electoral version of what Suharto's dictatorship was like. And if he keeps going, some of us are worried that all of those predictions of real fascism may have already come. And so it is a terrifying time to be alive, but it's probably always been a terrifying time to have this conversation.
Well, but also it's becoming more visible. And I must say, the good thing about the internet is people can check this out for now. Maybe that plug will be pulled even within the next weeks or months. But right now, anything we said here can be checked out, challenged. You can do your own research. And that's why I keep doing these podcasts. I don't want anybody to take what we say to be certainly not the final word, put on your bullshit detector. Maybe we're full of it also. So challenge us. Anyway, if you didn't get enough to challenge, check out the next issues. I used to say every week on NPR, but NPR, concerned about their funding, perhaps no longer is an outlet for this show, but certainly you can get it on the internet, sharepost.com. And I want to thank you again for cooperating on this. I want to thank Joshua Scheer, our executive producer, who found your article and insisted on doing this, as he does with all our guests. Diego Ramos, who is the managing editor of SharePost and who writes the introduction for this. Max Jones, who does the video, is also the producer of the Chris Hedges interview show. The JKW Foundation, which in the memory of Gene Stein, a fiercely independent writer and public intellectual, gives us some funding, along with Integrity Media in Chicago, inspired by Len Goodman, a terrific lawyer in that area, defending a lot of people's rights who don't get good lawyering, and for giving us also some support. See you next week with another edition of Share Intelligence.